Hi, this is the Movies You Love podcast. It's the podcast where I get to sit down and talk with all sorts of amazing people about the movies they love and the movies that help them fall in love with movies. And this week, I have the amazing, the wonderful, the kind of crazy at times. I mean, if you follow him on Twitter, he can be kind of crazy. I hope he doesn't think that's weird, me calling him crazy. But it's in an amazing way. It's in a lovable way. Mr. Matt Brown, host of the show Mammo, which you can find over at mammo.ca. The show is also hosted over on row3.com. And he posts all sorts of crazy stuff going on through Tedric.com. I discover that it's pronounced Tedric, not Derek. And you find out why very in the show. He also has a weekly column over at twitchfilm.com called Destroy All Monsters, where he sits down and discusses a topic from the week, has to do with popular culture, very much like with all of his other content, has to do with popular culture. And of course, we go deep into the realm of popular culture. I think I even say those exact words when I'm phrasing it in the podcast, as we sit down to talk Star Wars. It's amazing, like how Matt says himself, that no one has taken this film so far in the series, because it is one of those films. It's one of those films that so many people have been touched by. It's a childhood movie that people have seen over and over again, and then it kind of gets them into things, and it's amazing. I will put at the top a small apology. And I'm not really apologizing for the show, I'm apologizing for technology. Because while I adore technology and I work in technology, this is an example of technology failing here and there. So, for those of you who don't know, I record this show over Skype. And in case you didn't know this, Skype is a bucket of bolts. And I generally don't like Skype that much, but it really makes it easy for recording, because I don't like to have the guests having to do their own recordings, because I want to take the burden off of them. And I guess I'm going to go do some research into how to do this better, how to make internet better, because there are points within this where the quality just shifted up and down. There are a couple points where Matt drops in, but it's like barely a second most of the times. It's like just like there, and I didn't really do any cutting or any working on it, mainly because when I was listening back to it, most of the time you can understand what he was saying, you could understand where he was going with it. So I hope it doesn't, if this is the first episode you're hearing, I hope this doesn't stop you from listening to more. And if this is episode number 10, as it is in the series that you're listening to, I hope this doesn't make you go, screw this podcast, they don't know how to do audio. I really hope, because as I've always been saying, this is a fantastic podcast, or at least I like to think it is, and I hope that you guys are enjoying it as much as I am recording them. So without any more fanfare or discussion, I want to go straight into the podcast. So remember, this is Matt Brown of Mammo, of Tedric, of Twitch Film, of Row 3, and this is Star Wars. Enjoy.
Luke Skywalker was just a farm boy until he received a mysterious message from a princess.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
She's beautiful.
Star Wars, starring Mark Hamill.
I'm Luke Skywalker. I'm here to rescue you.
Aren't you a little short for a stormtrooper?
Harrison Ford.
Boring conversation anyway.
Luke, we're gonna have company!
I think we took a wrong turn.
Carrie Fisher.
Good luck.
Alec Guinness.
You can't win, Darth. If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine.
20th Century Fox presents the most extraordinary motion picture of all time, Star Wars.
Here's where the fun begins.
No legendary adventure of the past could be as exciting as this romance of the future.
Here they come.
May the Force be with you in Star Wars.
Okay, Mr. Matt Brown, thank you for coming on and finally being the first person that I can honestly say I have now conquered your little corner of the internet, because I, between you and Matt Price, I have conquered Mamo, I'd like to think.
Yes, you absolutely have. And you've been on Mamo. You've kind of done the hat trick. Like, you're completely, you've won.
Oh, I like to hear that so much. I know I shouldn't, but I do. but this week you have asked us to go into the realm of popular culture, which is your realm of knowledge, because your life, your expression on the internet so far, as I understand it, has been one of understanding popular culture as it relates to film. And we're going to delve so deeply in it today with the utilization of George Lucas's 1977 film Star Wars.
Yeah, as my good friend C-3PO likes to say, we're doomed. This is a deep rabbit hole. There's no telling how far down we could go.
We're going to try. So, as always, I like to start out with the simple thought, the simple idea of wondering, what was the first time you actually sat down and saw this film? Tell me about that and your experience with it.
Yeah, sure. I had, this is how sick my lifelong relationship with Star Wars is. It is literally my first memory. I was taken to see Star Wars by my dad when I was about 2 and a bit years old. It was one of the re-releases. They re-released Star Wars every summer between 77 and 80 when Empire came out. So I think it was probably either the summer of 78 or summer of 79. Popular vote favored summer of 79 because I would have been like 2 3/4. And my dad took me to the movie theater. I sat down. I remember very little of the movie, but my first conscious memory as a human being is the shot of the Star Destroyer flying overhead, because I remember looking up at the ceiling of the movie theater trying to figure out where that big-ass ship was coming from, and obviously seeing a beam of light. So you could say, like, my entire understanding of cinema was, like, built at that moment where it's like, there's an image in front of me, it's a Star Destroyer, there's this beam of light from the projector that is creating it somehow, but I don't understand how, and kind of everything that's happened since then, right up until this moment, has been in some way me trying to answer that question.
So, oddly enough, I don't think I've ever talked to anyone who's remembered seeing a movie at such a young age. I'd imagine for a lot of films, and even that image that you describe of the Star Destroyer coming over, it could turn to a child to be more frightening than enjoyment. How did that image play for you at that time?
Oddly, nothing about Star Wars itself ever frightened me. I was a very easily frightened kid. Like, I was scared to death during E.T. Obviously, like, stuff like Temple of Doom traumatized the holy crap out of me. But I think with the exception of Luke getting his hand cut off in Empire, nothing the Star Wars trilogy ever scared me. I was just too excited and amazed.
Wow. So this is a film which, for many parts, it delves into a lot of interesting things for something which kind of purports itself to be almost the beginning of blockbusters. I know people like to give that title to the likes of Jaws, and I don't have my years in front of me to make sure I have this correct, but somehow there's something about Star Wars which is more than what Jaws did when it comes to being the blockbuster in its entire scope and the reality it tries to give us. With this movie, as it's been a long time with us in the world of cinema, how do you view its own scope, just as A New Hope? Because I know when you look at it, we already have 6 episodes now. We're going to be looking at 9 by the time another decade rolls around. What do you see when you look at the scope that this movie actually tries to give us within A New Hope alone?
Well, I mean, what occurred to me recently watching the movie again, and I mean, this is kind of a basic thought, so maybe this shouldn't have occurred to me recently, but it's like, there's no shot in Star Wars. I call it Star Wars. I never call it A New Hope, because when I was a kid, even though that subtitle was on there and we knew that it was supposed to be called A New Hope, none of us did. We all just called it Star Wars Empire and Jedi. But Star Wars is like every shot, every single thing in it must have been unimaginably hard to make, right? There is no shot of Star Wars that is easy. So I kind of recognize and understand Lucas's frustrations. Like, he's certainly on the record with how frustrating it was to make that movie, because he's creating from whole cloth a world that is like terrifyingly realistic for something that is completely made up. You know, I went to see Pacific Rim with my girlfriend the other day, and she turned to me and said one of the things she liked was that the Pacific Rim looked used. And it's like, even that, like, as everyone knows, you can trace straight back to Star Wars, that idea that if you want a universe to have that kind of verisimilitude, that realism, you've got to beat the hell out of it, because there's nothing in, I mean, I dropped my iPhone on the ground yesterday, so there's this nice long silver scar down the side of it. And it's like, that's the real world. That's where things actually exist. And Star Wars, I think it's biggest, I mean, if you just leave aside the whole blockbuster thing, I think its biggest contribution just to filmmaking was that idea of make it as real as possible, give it as much texture and depth as possible, and people will tumble into it. Like, they will never be able to find their way out, because Star Wars doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense why that movie was the thing that so many people, and we're talking a lot of people, got their kind of cinematic bug from. But it, right, it was the one thing that sort of unified everybody's imaginations in that time period, and it just continued to do so right up till the present day.
I mean, one really small detail, which I noticed this time around, I actually sat down and rewatched the entire trilogy, Star Wars, as you call it, all the way to Jedi, and I realized this in A New Hope, in Star Wars more than anything else, which was that for some reason this might have been the first movie to pull off the translation gag, which you see in so many movies nowadays. I actually remember one of the earliest ones that I consciously got it, and it was because it pointed to it so quickly and so obviously, was Ocean's 11, where they had a character speaking a completely other language. They refused to subtitle it, but magically everyone understood what was going on in the movie, and you just kind of placed in your own dialogue into that character. In this movie, there are myriads of cultures and lives and languages being spoken, but there's always someone there, and there are very few times where they take the time to subtitle or even have someone translate the conversation going on. You just hear the one side of it, like it's a phone call, and you just kind of assume as it's going on. You're like, oh, Chewbacca must have said this at that point, which is why Han Solo's doing this. This is just a tiny little detail, which, as you say, creates this very realized world. And I can only imagine what kind of things we have to do culturally to reach that point where everyone is on the same playing field when it comes to languages and cultural understanding. I mean, how does that as an element for a film even come close to what you hope for the world that we're moving into going forward?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. And I mean, like, in Star Wars particularly, like, I'm thinking of the scene between Han and Greedo. I almost get disappointed when there are subtitles, because so much of the rest of the fabric of the film is made up of one, like you said, one character talking and you don't understand what he's saying. Like, R2 and Chewie are the best examples, but there are others. And everyone just sort of gets it, you know, they just understand. And it's like, Star Wars is not spoken of like Star Trek, about like being a hopeful vision of the future of society. But one thing it never gets core is that sort of just broad-based multicultural concept, you know, that the whole universe would become a melting pot and everybody would kind of share some elements of culture and some elements of language and so on and so forth. But there wouldn't be, I mean, one thing there never is in Star Wars, there's never like race-based hatred. I think some of like the comic books and stuff like that tried to turn the Empire into kind of more of a Nazi vibe, being that like the Emperor wanted, you know, only white people or something like that. But it's like, there's no evidence of that in the actual films. There's none of those kinds of demarcations are drawn. They actually, ironically, the only race-based hatred in Star Wars is between humans and droids, because droids are slaves who not only kind of don't even really seem to know they're slaves, they don't even seem to mind they're slaves, right? They just sort of take it, they get abused. None of the humans ever question whether it's okay for these droids to be slaves. They're just sort of treated like shit it. And if, you know, if you got to blow up a droid or wipe its memory or whatever else, like whatever horrible thing to do to a creature that supposedly feels pain and has a soul, they just do it and they don't even think about it. Other than that, it's a very tolerant society in the Star Wars universe.
Definitely. I mean, we have to wait until, and I know this might be blasphemy to even bring up, the prequels. I remember seeing, and that I haven't seen in forever, I think since it was originally released, seeing things like the Anakin Skywalker, who was supposed, like his mother was a slave of some kind, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the only time which we see any form of non-droid oppression happening within this universe.
Yes, exactly. I mean, aside from the obvious, you know, in the original trilogy, the, you know, the Empire exists and we presume that they are oppressing people, but they don't even really seem to be oppressing anybody that hard. Like, I'm not coming out, you know, swinging for the dark side boys, because I know they're responsible for a lot of bad shit. But, you know, I think Lucas's metaphor, and it is a good metaphor, is that just that the Empire was a corrupt bureaucracy more than anything else. Like, it was just a bad government. Darth Vader might have been running around killing people, but for the most part, the problem with the Empire is just that it's a government that doesn't really work well.
Well, when you think about it, I don't think we ever really know that they have a plan. They just are there, and we only know that they're against the rebels.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, I'm not as anti the prequels as most people. I did enjoy those movies, but let's leave those out of the conversation because they fill in parts of the story that are, I think, better left kind of not filled in. Like, one of the things that everyone loves about Star Wars is that single reference to the Clone Wars, which never gets explained. You just know that Ben and Anakin fought in something called the Clone Wars, which took place in the past. And what I like about Star Wars is, much like the use of language, it's inviting you to use your imagination and figure it out, right? It's not telling you what the details are. But you're right when you say that in Star Wars itself, like if you just took Star Wars Episode 4 as a single movie, you have no idea how long the Empire has existed. You have no idea what their plan is or if they have a plan. They just sort of exist. And they don't like the rebels, so they've created this Death Star to blow up planets. And yeah, that's pretty mean. But it's like, if the rebels didn't exist, would the Death Star exist?
It's a weird place to start thinking about sides and actual rights and wrongs and needing more information to judge, you know?
Yes, absolutely. We don't, like, we know that people are, what, you know, one of the things that Star Wars, I may be kind of getting ahead of myself a little bit here, because one of the things that is obviously true of Star Wars is that it was designed with a very simplistic iconography. Here are the good guys. Here are the bad guys. These are the white hats. These are the bad hats. We're going to tell you right at the beginning of the film that the Empire is bad, and you're just going to go with it. But one of the things that's been so much fun about Star Wars in the years since is that thing where you start to do the Kevin Smith thing, where you start to wonder, well, who built the Death Star? What about all those guys that were on the Death Star when Lando blew it up in Return of the Jedi? Like, you start having those conversations with yourself, and it all becomes much more morally relative. And I find that whole process, it may not inform your viewing of the film at all, but it's fun, and it's a testament to the universe that Lucas built that you can have those conversations, that those offshoots and ideas exist there, and you can follow them and find interesting, you know, at best an interesting joke, or maybe further an interesting idea.
So definitely one of the big elements of this film has to do with the Jedi, the idea of the dark side, and I don't even know if they call it the light side. It's just the Force. I think that's very interesting. That there's the Force, which both sides use, but they only call the bad side the dark side. They don't call the good side anything.
Yeah, no, the good side is presumed to be just good, so it's the Force. Yeah, and then there's the dark side of the Force, which you don't really want to use.
And I have to say that what I'm about to extrapolate, you kind of have to go into the entire trilogy to start to see some of these things come out, which is kind of the starting points of what the film posits to be the dark side. And it's questioning your beliefs, questioning the things that come from your... questioning these things that have been given to you, these things that have been given to you as absolute truths. And I know that it's always been in there, but I've never really thought about it too hard until this recent viewing, where it kind of plays perfectly into the thoughts of religion, where there is, within Christianity, which is a very the prominent religion throughout the, I won't say the world, but at least throughout America, which is where I'd guess George Lucas is taking all of his inspirations from, his own social backgrounds. But it's this weird place where you realize that the moment that Luke starts to question these things, the Force, question how these things work, why is it that we have to do it this way, why, that we then start to see people talk about, oh, you're going to the dark side. So is this Lucas's attempt at trying to discuss heresy in any way?
That's a really good question. I mean, one of the things that you've got to think about whenever you've got dogma in any mythology is, you know, is the person that is questioning it and therefore evil, so let's say Darth Vader, the fallen angel, is he a bad guy or is he just a guy who wanted knowledge and the gods kind of smacked him down? Right. There's that. There's always going to be that sort of Satan Lucifer vibe, or if you will, a Prometheus vibe to the question of questioning the gods. Right. So you're right. Like Luke pretty much does what he's told right up until about the end of Empire when he decides he's going to go off to Cloud City. That's the first time he stands up against the teachings of Ben Yoda and says, no, wait, I'm in it for myself. I got to go help my friends. And obviously that leads to bad things. So you've got to wonder, is one of the things that Lucas is doing trying to reinforce the notion of dogma for young people? Because the reason he made the movie, or one of the reasons he made the movie originally, was he's like, look, when I was growing up, there were Westerns, and Westerns kind of taught you right and wrong when you were between the age of, say, 6 and 12 and you were a boy. There were the good guys, there were the bad guys, like I was saying before. He wanted to be like the good guys, and there were these very simple moral tales about how to be a good person in the world. It's the same reason C.S. Lewis wrote the Chronicles of Narnia. He was like, I want to write parables for young people to learn how to be a good person in the world. So Lucas said, there used to be Westerns, now there's not Westerns anymore. I want to make a new thing that's like that. It's the same thing for 12-year-olds, but it's a different genre. So he makes Star Wars. So I think one of the things you've got to teach young people, oddly enough, is to not question too much at the beginning. At some point, you've got to teach young people to start to question and to start being media savvy and start having those conversations. But you can't do that at the start. You have to establish sort of some ability to trust what you're being taught, or you're never going to get taught anything. And then when you're like 16, 17, 18, then you can be like, okay, let's start questioning the shit that we're being handed. And maybe, you know, we all grew up with Star Wars, and by the time we got to the end of Empire, we were ready to question whether Yoda and Obi-Wan were right. Because even though Luke gets his ass handed to him on Cloud City, there's also the fact that he finds out that Ben lied, right? That's the most, when you look at the saga as a whole, one of the most tantalizing elements of Star Wars Episode 4 itself is the fact that Ben lies. Without a second thought, and I mean, we can step outside the narrative a minute and say it's probably because Lucas didn't know that Anakin was Luke's father at that moment. But within the narrative, right there in his little hut, Ben just lies to Luke. He just flat out says, oh, no, yeah, your father, Darth Vader killed him. It was horrible. And so you have to wonder what kind of seed of dissent is Lucas planting there, intentionally or unintentionally, that's going to grow into the end of The Empire Strikes Back. I just talked for a really long time. Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did, sir. Do not worry.
Okay.
You're not supposed to embrace fear. You are not to go to the dark side.
That's, yeah, fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate.
And that's weird enough. I don't know. It kind of clicked with me this weekend, rewatching the films, that the Jedis kind of have the same ideals as the Green Lanterns. And I'm not a big fan of the Green Lanterns. I'm not that big a comic book geek, but it kind of clicked with me this weekend. And that was kind of weird.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the things that, you know, again, like I said, I like the prequel trilogy, but one of the things that, you know, wasn't really, the hardest thing about watching the prequels was what about it didn't connect with what I'd imagined when I was a kid. And I'd never imagined the Jedi as like intergalactic police / ambassadors, you know, like that wasn't really what I conceived of. And so you're absolutely right. When you look at the space cops, the Green Lantern Corps, they're a lot closer to the Jedi than I'd like.
Yeah. But bring it back a little bit to the religion and the theology. I'm kind of curious as to, cause I have no ideas as to where you lie within the story of religion and theology. But I'm kind of curious, do you take things from this movie into your understanding of religion and theology at all?
Yes, I absolutely. I mean, like, as a person, as an adult, I'm an atheist, but one of the elements of being an atheist is I firmly believe, no matter what you believe, you need to believe in something, right? Everyone needs something that they can take meaning from to kind of shape their understanding of their purpose in life. And ironically enough, being a person that was not, I was raised by a lapsed Catholic and a lapsed Anglican, so there was no real religion in my household, but there was Star Wars, right? Like, it's this weird thing where as you grow up, because I think every human being needs something that helps them make meaning, maybe one of the reasons Star Wars is so popular in what we could argue is we're arriving at a post-religious age. But one of the reasons maybe Star Wars is so popular is that it does posit some very basic theological ideas just in a completely different context. It's the same, I think, Superman's popular, right? Like, it's not that far removed from basic Judeo-Christian iconography. It's just it happens to take place in outer space, and there's lightsabers and robots. And me being the person that I am, I like lightsabers and robots a lot more than people being nailed to crosses. So maybe that's why I identify with it.
Yeah. The Superman thing, I always love when people bring up Superman as it comes to religion, because I don't know where I heard this, but there was something I saw, and there was a guy who apparently got to be a professor in a comic book related course at some college, and he's apparently people always gave him shit. Like, he would be the guy, the comic nerd, who's like, look, these things, as silly as you think they are, they're important. And then some guy from religion and theology came up to him and said, look, you're talking horseshit. And he's like, all right, explain to me the story of Moses. He describes the story of Moses. He says, explain to me the story of Superman. And he stops halfway through and goes, oh, shit, you can have a class.
Yep, exactly. And I mean, to an extent, right, this is the other thing. The other reason Lucas wanted to make film was he wanted to explore this Joseph Campbell idea, and there I did it. I promised myself I wasn't going to bring up Joseph Campbell because it's the most hack thing you can say about Star Wars, but God damn it, I'm doing it anyway. He wanted to explore this idea that across the entire planet, you can boil all of our major mythologies down to a few key points, and whether it's, you know, Isis and Osiris in Egypt, or whether it's, again, the Prometheus myth, or whether it's Moses or whatever else, or whether it's Star Wars or Superman, there are these core elements, and you can construct a story that kind of on a weird primordial psychological level that we don't even fully understand reinforces things that we need to understand about life and death and the meaning of life, right? Like when Luke and Han go into the trash compactor, it seems like a very innocuous set piece. Oh, they got trapped in the garbage thing, right? But there's this hidden psychological meaning for young people particularly about the idea of being taken inside the belly of a beast or the belly of the whale in the case of the Jonah story. And it's like by facing that moment of death and then coming out, even though they just get the door open and walk out, you're satisfying kind of psychological need for catharsis that we don't even know we have. So movies like Star Wars, and it was very specifically designed to take advantage of some of these ideas, the reason they connect, I think, is that they connect with that spiritual, religious, or what created the spiritual, religious, mythic context as well. It all comes from the same place in the way that I analyze it. It's like we have these needs on a psychological level as humans, as mammals. The Bible fills those needs. Superman fills those needs, Star Wars fills those needs, and it's just sort of like up to the subjective interests of the person of which one they're going to connect to the most strongly.
So I'm going to take half a second to pat myself on the back, because I'm going to admit to you that around 2 hours ago, I finally listened to your latest Mammal, the Lone Ranger episode, where you mentioned the fact that you're coming on this podcast, and you brought up three specific things to say, I don't know if I'm going to talk about these things, and that was one of them. So I'm going to give myself a smile back.
Yeah, if you get the hat trick, then let me know. I'll be up here next time you're in Toronto.
So the movie in itself, as we've talked about, discusses a lot of things, but there's one element which I always love to discuss when it comes to films like this, because this movie has had so much around it that you kind of can't talk about just the narrative anymore. It becomes about the social element of it and the even historical element of the film as it moved from year to year to year. And with a property like this, which has gone through so many iterations, there have been so much fan fiction that then became official fiction, that then became cross platforms, that then became all sorts of things. Where does the mythos end and begin when it comes to Star Wars? Are fans allowed to enjoy their own little chunk of Star Wars and ignore the rest? Because I've had to debate with my friends for many a years where we can only say that 10% of Star Wars is good, because it's only really the first trilogy that a lot of people want to admit are actually good, whether you as an individual like it all or not.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that actually gives me, you know, the reason I think I can be okay with the prequels, and particularly the reason I think I can be okay with Episode 7, because I always knew there was going to be prequels, right? I grew up expecting the prequels. I never thought there was going to be an Episode 7. But this weird thing happened to me since Revenge of the Sith came out, which is I started kind of grappling with that question, which is like, is the thing that I consider to be Star Wars, which really, again, even though I like the prequels, will always just be Star Wars, Empire and Jedi. It'll be those three films, which you said was 10%. I'd say is actually like maybe 3% of the whole Star Wars universe that exists. Right? Like, yeah. It's such a tiny, it's the head of an enormous iceberg. So what I consider to be Star Wars for a long time, me and a lot of people like me, I think, held to be very sacrosanct. I think that's why so many people were pissed off at the prequels, right? They feel this sense of ownership of what Star Wars is. They know what the definition of it is. And when they see something that defies that definition, they get really pissed off. Now, I was, in the space of like a weekend, like maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I went to a Toys R Us and I saw like a 4-year-old boy wearing a Clone Wars t-shirt buying Clone Wars action figures. And then it was the same time that Star Wars Kinect game came out with the dance-along component. I don't know if you've seen it or heard it, but there's a song called I'm Han Solo where you dance as Han Solo in the carbon freezing chamber. And anyway, I was thinking about those two things and I was like, I bet this pisses a lot of people off, but it gives me actually an enormous sense of completion to think that Star Wars has kind of expanded to the point where there are kids today who are going to like Star Wars for reasons that have nothing to do with why I liked Star Wars when I was a kid. They've got their own little province of it that they live in. And the Clone Wars TV show is great, by the way, so I'm not trying to denigrate it. I think it's fantastic. But it's like if the only reason they like it is because of the TV show or because they like the Lego Star Wars video game or because they like to dance along as Han Solo in Star Wars Kinect, I'm like, awesome. Like, live it up. Who am I as a 36-year-old old fart to tell you you're not allowed to love Star Wars this way and that your love of it is any less legitimate than mine? I had my thing. I had my time. And everyone is welcome to enjoy this universe in whatever capacity or context they see fit.
That's quite lovely of you, sir.
Thanks.
So there is one other element as it comes to the transcendence of the Star Wars, the whole history of Star Wars, and that has to do with the idea of Lucas and his always want to revisit the films. Because it's not so much him wanting to make prequels or sequels or having these things, as he'd like to let us know, written down and in a safe for the last 30 years, that he's just been waiting for the chance to let them out. And however true that is, that's irrelevant to me. But the idea that it's kind of like when you have this toy and you thought there was a little thing you could have changed to make it better, but sadly at the time you couldn't have done it. But today you can do it. And he says, I'm going to do it because he can. Like, does that touch you as a filmmaker in any reach?
Well, as a filmmaker, I absolutely get it, right? Like, I can't remember who said it. It's quite a famous quote. I apologize to whoever did. Films aren't finished. They're abandoned. It's absolutely true. There will always be things about any creative work, it's not just limited to films, that kind of drive you insane after the fact. And I don't, on an intellectual level, have a problem with Lucas tinkering with his old movies. I think, you know what, it's not a big deal. My problem as a film goer and as a film fan and as a film historian is the destruction of the original versions, right? Like, I'm like, if there is a library copy of a 70 millimeter print of Star Wars in the Library of Congress that people can have access to for the next 500 years, that's fine if you want to screw around and make an alternate version with your little CGI droids in it beating each other over the head. But if you are replacing the 1977 version of Star Wars with whatever new version you think is better, I really think you're doing an enormous service, not just to film history, but to art history, right? Like, one of the reasons Star Wars is as influential as it is that it completely revamped visual effects as we know it. Well, if you're taking that film and you're removing all of that revamping work and replacing it with new CGI stuff, then we have no ability as a culture to look back and say, what was that? What made that change? Like, what was motion control photography as applied to spaceships in 1977? Why was it such a big deal? Like, if there are no copies of that, if there are no pristine versions of that that we can look at and screen in a movie theater and kind of take apart as a cultural artifact, you're doing a huge disservice to the history of cinema. And what drives me insane about Lucas doing it is that theoretically he agrees with everything I'm saying, right? Like, he was one of the strong people to come out against colorizing old movies and all this other stuff. Like, he's deeply into film history, except when it applies to his movie, which he insists he released a rough draft into the world in 1977, and he has the right to call back that rough draft and give us what he considers to be the final version. And I say bullshit. You don't have that right. You released it. It's part of the world. As much as, yes, you are the copyright owner on it, we as a culture also own it to a very real extent. Like, if Da Vinci popped up today and said, you know, the Mona Lisa was never supposed to be smiling. She's supposed to frown. I'm just going to paint over that. We wouldn't fucking let him. Like, it has nothing to do with whether or not he's got the right. We wouldn't let him, because that's a cultural document that matters to us as a people. And I would argue that Star Wars is the same thing. Like, the people will disagree with me, and your listeners may get pissed off, and I welcome them to. I would argue, and kind of always have, that Star Wars is the movie, that it is the movie that defines movies. Like, you can make a case for Casablanca, Citizen Kane, Wizard of Oz, whatever else. But, like, Star Wars is, I think, the movie that does what movies does the best. It's the best example of this popular art form at its most popular. I think if 500 years from now, if there is only one movie left that the aliens come down and they're like, what was movies, humans? And we're like, it's this movie. It's going to be Star Wars. Like, if that's what it's going to be. And I'm like, it had better be the 1977 version of Star Wars, because the special edition is not the thing itself. It's another thing. And you're lying to your cultural history when you claim that the 77 version doesn't exist. Wow, I just went on a long-winded rant.
I told you, sir. I gave you the warning beforehand. Do not apologize ever.
Yeah.
But herein lies the thing. Like, just like how you said, it's the fact that it makes the original version more and more difficult to find, which is that even for this, when I was rewatching, I accidentally made the mistake of buying the latest Blu-ray release, and then it was the remastered edition, the re-released edition, where he did all these touches. And I was watching it closely, and I found it baffling to see what he thought. And of course, we can always go into the artist's vision discussion, but that's always a quandary of things. What he thought was worthwhile to touch up and what he thought wasn't, where he was like, that can stay, right? Because there are certain things in there where you realize that it doesn't look as tangible as the 1977 version graphics. I mean, yes. you could argue that back then they had to use real models and that kind of helped it being tangible, but it's still weird in how it comes off. Like, I don't know if you've actually seen these versions completely. I don't know if you're one of those people who saw 20 minutes and said, screw this noise. But in Jedi, during the whole the scene in Jabba's cave, there's actually an insertion of a whole new song where he CG'd in characters, new alien characters, to sing this big jazz song, which it just feels crazy that he thought that was so important.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And I mean, again, you know, in 97, when the Return of the Jedi special edition came out and that song came, I loved it. I thought it was hilarious. You know, I was like, I was a little disappointed because I liked the other version of the song and I liked the puppets and all that, but I didn't really mind because back then he wasn't making such a big deal out of, I'm never going to release the original versions of these. He just sort of like, we buffed these up for their 20th anniversary and go see them in the movie theaters. And I was like, that's great. But, you know, I went to a secret screening 2 years ago of a print of Return of the Jedi from 1983, so the original one. And the print was basically unwatchable. Like, it was in disastrously ill shape. And that's what happens to film prints. That's what happens to everything. And it really made me think, you know, because when I was a kid, I saw Return of the Jedi in theaters probably like 4 to 6 times. And I'm sitting there watching this thing at the secret screening, and it's an actual film print. It's going through the projector, and it looks like it. And I'm like, I really hope this is not the last time I ever get to see Return of the Jedi in a movie theater, because it's designed to be seen in a movie theater. I can get the bootleg, non-special edition, digital copy off the internet and watch it on my TV at home. But that's not really the same thing. Like, this movie was designed to be seen in a theater, and the movie that was designed to be seen in a theater in 1983 is kind of gone now. It's been replaced with the CGI Muppet version musical number that you alluded to.
It's kind of crazy. But I'm very curious because we've never talked about this, and I've only heard about this, you know, through murmurs of the internet, through little things you send out into the world, that you're actually, your profession is somewhat into filmmaking, or is that full on filmmaking? I have no clue.
Well, I do make my living making industrial videos for a large company here. And yes, I make my own films on the side. So you could say I'm a professional filmmaker.
So what is it that actually inspired you into that line of work?
Well, you know, it was this really weird, I saw there was a special on the making of The Empire Strikes Back that came out about a year after Empire came out. And I think it's actually on the Blu-ray set that you bought. And there was something about seeing the curtain lifted. Like, maybe it was the answer to that question that I asked when I was 3, which is, where is that Star Destroyer coming from? There was something about seeing that curtain lifted up, of seeing how they put those ships on screen. Like, one of my favorite parts of that special was they showed you how they blew up a snowspeeder, and they basically ran it down a wire in front of a blue screen, and they put an explosive in it and so on and so forth. But they mentioned that it took 8 hours to do that one shot. And I was like, whatever that job is, whatever that guy just said, I want to do that. That is, like, there was something about the attention to detail, the craftsmanship at work, that just attracted me like a fly to a bug zapper, you know? Like, I just became obsessed with it. And I immediately, you know, grabbed the family video camera and just started trying to replicate not just effects, but the stories and the characters and the ideas as closely as I could. And they were terrible. But it's like that kind of visual imagination that I think Star Wars represents, coupled with the analog creation of special effects, was just candy to me at that age. Like, and it kind of still is. Like, I think if I was going to make a feature film now and add special effects in it, I'd just be like, can we just do it on a blue screen with motion control? Because it's going to look so much better.
So how is it that you gauge your own taste when it comes to film culture, when it relates to special effects, as it goes from 1977 to today? Where is it that you see as your sweet spot of special effects coming to us as viewers?
Sweet spot is probably still the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and I'm not including The Hobbit, not because I don't like The Hobbit, but because there's no miniatures in The Hobbit. The combination of elements that they did for Lord of the Rings with the giant ass miniatures and all of the like, I love digital character animation. I have no problem with, like, the Gungans and the Jar Jars of the world. I find that whole art form fascinating. But I'm like, if you want to do Minas Tirith or a Star Destroyer, I really admire, like, to the point of almost, you know, like, feeling that heart swelling pride. I really admire model makers. I think what they do for a living is astonishing. I think the fact that their whole art form is kind of going away is really sad, you know? Like, it's just such a beautiful art form. And if you go back through the history of film, there's so many amazing examples of it, right? And it's just, it's becoming less and less and less and less and less. And then you get to something like The Hobbit, where because of 3D and 48 frames per second, they can't do miniatures anymore at all. A lot of people don't know this, but there's actually a lot of miniatures on the Star Wars trilogy. Like, there's all kinds of stuff that they could do with digital that they just did with miniatures. Like, miniatures are awesome, you know? And I that's, so you want my sweet spot? That's my sweet spot. Build as many things as you physically can. Like, when I make these, I am really interested in the collision of physically tangible objects, whether they're literally colliding or just sort of, you know, theoretically colliding. Like, I like real things happening. I guess I'm a bit of a Christopher Nolan, right? Like, if I could flip over an 18-wheeler in the middle of Chicago, because I want to see what that's like, you know? And it's like, there's a degree to which I admire what Pacific Rim does, because I really do. I thought Pacific Rim was terrific. But there's that part of your brain where it's like, yeah, but they're big CGI robots, you know? It's impressive, but it's not that impressive.
Yeah, I get that. There's always that feeling of grand establishment when you go to a film, when you see a film 40 years old, and you kind of take a moment and you realize they had to build this. They couldn't do what they did in all my favorite movies today, where they kind of cop out and go, all right, the actors aren't here, let's make a CGI model and we go. They had to build this, and it just puts you in a state of awe for a little bit whenever that comes to mind.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you find out, you know, years after the fact that a shot was like forced perspective or something else, and you're just like, man, movie making is such a magic trick. Like, again, to go to Christopher Nolan, like, it's such a magic trick, and it was particularly a magic trick when it was an entirely analog process, because you really were just fooling around with, like, chemicals and molecules and, like, physical, like, film as a physical object. You were tricking it into showing you what you wanted to fool the eye with. Now that it's 3D CGI and all this, and I'm trying not to be the cantankerous guy, because, again, I love all that stuff. I really do. But now that it's a thing, it's like it just becomes significantly less impressive than the dopey analog effects of, you know, back in the day. Or, you know, or doing something for real. Like, one of my favorite films is The Wicker Man. You know what I love about that movie? At the end, they built a Wicker Man and they set it on fire, right? That thing actually just burned to the ground in front of a crowd of 40 people because that was the best way to do it. And I love that stuff when they're like, we're never going to get a chance to do this again. We're setting this Wicker Man on fire. We better have film in the camera. You know, like, there's a little frenzy about that just you cannot replicate with CGI.
You know, part of me kind of just flicks back to moments like in Tropic Thunder, where they have the big explosion and then someone says to the director the camera wasn't running. And you just imagine the pain in people's hearts when things like that
happen. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, one of the things, like, I went to film school kind of in the last days of the analog age, so I actually got to shoot film. And I tell everyone this, a film camera running literally sounds like money running down a drain. That is the sound of a film motor running film through a camera. So, yeah, when something doesn't go off, you feel pretty bad. Like, I get, again, like I said earlier, I get why Lucas was so frustrated. Making a movie on film in an analog universe is like jumping backwards onto a moving skateboard with a blindfold on. It's, you never know if what you're trying to get is actually going to be what you get. So that's got to be incredibly frustrating. And I see why having like a video village and the ability to play back takes immediately on a gigantic screen with your 3D glasses on, I get why that's really appealing, but you're losing something at the same time.
So, moving forward, because your show, if none other that I listen to on the internet, lives in the realm of speculation and discussion of where popular culture is going to keep going. Because as we talk about this franchise, we are, is it 2 years out from seeing the J.J. Abrams?
Yeah, I don't buy that they're done for 2015, but it's supposed to be in 2015.
Yeah. What is it that you can see happening post Luke winning the war?
That's a really good... See, one of the reasons Episode 7 drives me nuts as an idea is there are really no threads at the end of Episode 6. They actually tie up everything. Like, there is no element of that narrative that has been left open for further exploitation. So, I mean, in one sense, as a story, I'm sure that's very liberating for them, because they could basically go anywhere. They could set this thing 1,000 years in the future. They're apparently not, because they want 7 Han Solo in it, which I also think is a really bad idea. But, you know, if you ask me what's the story going to be about, I have to assume it's going to be very much like all of our kind of remake, reboot, reborkal tent poles right now, which is it's going to hit a lot of the beats of the original movie with a different cast and slightly different characters. So there'll be a young person who's going to be the Luke surrogate. There'll be a young person who's going to be the Leia surrogate. There'll be bad guys with red lightsabers that we have to fight. And hopefully it kind of takes off from there, because one of the things that I don't like about the prequels is everything in the prequels is a reference to the original trilogy, right? So instead of Stormtroopers, you've got Clone Troopers, and instead of Boba Fett, you've got Jango Fett. But it's all related to the original trilogy. If I want Episode 7 to do anything, it's like, just go somewhere else. Like, don't give us a new army of people dressed in white plastic who want to shoot the good guys. Come up with some new thing. Like, take it in a new direction. I just kind of doubt that they will. I think that's one of the reasons they hired Abrams. Like, Star Trek, the reboot, was great. Star Trek Into Darkness, less great. But it's like, what the guy is good at is sort of tapping the bases that are already there. Like, he's good at sort of being, yeah, that thing that you're familiar with that you like, I'm going to give you that thing. And it'll be all dusted up and pretty, and there'll be lens flare like crazy. But it'll remind you of why you like that thing that you like. And I'm like, you know, with Star Wars, no, man, just tell me a new story. Go somewhere new.
Well, Star Wars is somewhere new. It's always been somewhere new. That's the idea of Star Wars. Not to say that they've gone anywhere new in the last 30 years, but that's what they always hope to do.
Yep, absolutely. And that's why, you know, to this day, Empire is considered to be such a good sequel, because it is not anything like the first movie. Like, the easiest thing to do with a sequel is just sort of do over the basic beats of your first film. That's how they made 6 Rocky movies, right? But, like, Empire is nothing like Star Wars. It doesn't tell anything like the same kind of story. It goes in a completely different direction, and it is so much more rewarding for it.
There's this weird thing that I kind of remember, because as a child, while Star Wars was an important part of my movie-watching time, the only movie out of the films that I actually watched as a child was Jedi. Like, we had Jedi on cassette, and we used to watch that on repeat, right? And I don't remember, I know I probably had seen Empire and Star Wars at some point before, but I don't remember them. And there was always this moment in the final fight scene between Vader and Luke, where Luke cuts off Vader's hand. And then he looks to his own and you see the black hand. And for some reason in my brain, it told me that Luke was going to the dark side by killing his father. And he took on the black hand of Darth Vader. And I started to ask, will he cut up the wrist and get a black leg? And a black...
Wow, that's a great interpretation. And I kind of had very similar experiences. Like, it's such a weird primal scene, especially for a young boy. You know, like, the daddy issues in Return of the Jedi messed me up in a lot of interesting ways that I'm trying to unravel today.
It's kind of crazy. It's these little things about how you look at movies that just drive me wild.
Yep.
But out of curiosity, to talk a little bit more about what you're doing with your own voyeuristic discussions on film, is, like, what the heck happened with The Birth of Mamo? That show's been going on forever, and I'm so sad that I'm just catching on in the last couple of years. How did that show come to be, if at all?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, when I was, like, I met Matt Price in, I think, like, maybe 2001 or 2002. We were just at a poker game together. We didn't know each other before that. Just a friend of ours was running a poker table, and we would both go. And, you know, he's really obviously insanely insightful about movies to a degree that terrifies me. And I, you know, I'm interested in not just in movies and in, you know, my reactions to them, but sort of what became the Mamo concept, which is like, why are people liking what they're liking? Why is Hollywood making what they're making? So on and so forth. So for like 2003, 2004 and the beginning of 2005, Matt Price and I would find ourselves on the phone with each other on Monday morning, sort of talking about how the stuff over the weekend had done, or, like, you know, like when there was a piece of movie related news, we'd get on the phone and gab about it. And he had the brainwave in 2005 of just being like, he'd heard about this thing called a podcast, which I had not, memorably. I had to be told what a podcast was when he suggested it. But he heard about a podcast and he was like, you know, the conversations that we're having anyway could be a podcast. You know, we could just record them and put them out there and maybe people would like it. And so that's what we did. Like, I mean, he actually put out a call. It was originally, the idea was it was going to be kind of more like Dinner for Five, the Jon Favreau show. Like, he wanted kind of a panel, four or five people. No one else wanted to do it. They all thought he was a lunatic. So I was the only guy who signed up. And that's how we got to get started. But I think even when we got started, we thought we were only going to do a set number of shows. Like, we thought we would take whatever the big release was week by week and kind of spin out a conversation about its genre. So when, like, Hitch came out, for example, we started by looking at like romantic comedies, but then we ended up looking at movies with black main characters, which, you know, remains a fairly isolated niche, particularly in Hollywood. And we kind of thought, if we take that approach, we're just going to run out of topics for like 50 shows. But then we got to the 50 show mark and we kind of were like, well, it was kind of like Thelma and Louise staring at the Grand Canyon. We're like, let's just keep going. So we clasped hands and we stomped on the accelerator, and now Mamo is 8 years old as of last week.
Because I don't know if this is official, but you guys definitely are one of the oldest podcasts running on the internet.
Yeah, I think we are, and we don't know anything about what's official or not official because we're so incredibly lazy about sort of keeping track of how we're doing. Like, you're great, right? Like, you put up a tweet every now and again saying, go into iTunes and review my podcast. Because that's how podcasts get found. That's how podcasts rise to the top of the list of podcasts. We've never done anything like that. We've always just been sort of like, well, if people want to listen, they'll find us. And, you know, thank goodness we got on Row 3 in 2009, because they've obviously been a huge help in kind of pushing us. And the stuff we were doing for the Substream for the last couple of years, that helped push us. But we're so lackadaisical about examining our own achievements that we don't know. We could literally be the most popular podcast in the world and we wouldn't know.
And I'm sure you guys don't need to know. It'd probably hurt if you knew. Like, you guys would probably clam up if you knew. You'd be you're listening, aren't you?
Wait, you mean people are listening to this show and have opinions about our opinions?
But I guess I'm going to end on kind of the similar question that you started me with when we talked on the mic up at TIFF last year. Last year, you put me on the spot and asked me about where my name came from, where G-Man Reviews came from. I'm going to ask you, where did Tedric come from?
Tedric comes from my teddy bear. When I was minus 1 month old, my grandparents bought me a teddy bear, and I named him Tedric when I was like two. And it just sort of, because it's a weird word, it became a very easy thing to do for my internet handles as the internet became a thing in the 90s. And then, yeah, I went on my own website in 97. That became Tedric.com. And then, with like two exceptions, Tedric became my username on every social media platform on the planet.
That makes perfect sense, though, that you put it to a teddy bear as to why it sounds like Tetrick.
Yeah, exactly. And you're not the only person who thinks it's pronounced Tederic. I get that all the time. I think 95% of people think it's Tederic, and 5% know it's Tedric.
And now, hopefully, around 5.6% know it's
Tedric. Yes, I'm counting on your listeners to percentage.
To save you from having to explain it's not to Derek.
Yes, exactly.
Anyways, I'd like to thank you so much, for Mr. Matt Brown, for coming and talking to me tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And when you sent out the list of potential of things that had already been covered, I just assumed you'd made a typo by not putting Star Wars on there. I was like, surely someone's talked about Star Wars.
No one's taken Star Wars, but now it's taken. Now you have been the one to take Star Wars.
And I'm so grateful. Thanks for the opportunity.
No problem. So that was the podcast. I'd like to thank you so much for listening and enjoying. The next episode of this podcast, why don't I have this up right now in front of me like I should? I realize that I did this the first time and I haven't done it afterwards, and I should keep doing it. The next episode of this podcast is going to be going up on the 4th of August. So look forward to that. I have it semi-planned. I don't want to put foot in mouth and have something go bad, because that one's not in the can yet. But it should be really good. Otherwise, just enjoy the podcast. Go tell people about the podcast. Go rate and review the podcast. You can go listen to it through iTunes, through Stitcher, over on my website over at gmanreviews.com. And as always, you can email me. I am andrew.robinson@gmanreviews.com. You can tweet me. I am @gmanreviews. Let me know what you thought of the podcast. Or you can just leave a comment below, because comments are like little golden nuggets. They're things that make people like myself feel a lot better, because they're like, it kind of validates me. It makes me go, shit, people are listening, and I adore them. So every comment counts, every review or every rating counts, every tweet counts, because tweets count. People like to think they're just these things we throw out into the world and are disposable and we'll never remember them in 20 years. I'll tell that person they're lying. 20 years from today, I will look at that person in the face and I remember that tweet, and I will quote it to him, and he will look at me weirdly. But this is the outro. I should just be letting it go. So thanks so much for listening, and have a good night.